Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening to the Tableau on Tableau podcast with Wilson Poe and Charles Schaefer. I'm Charles Schaefer. A couple quick notes on this episode. We discussed dashboards, a bit about the history of BI projects, and then the next day, after we were done recording, we realized that this discussion really dovetails nicely into points about storytelling and the best way to do dashboards. So you might notice a little bit of a break around the 45-minute mark, followed by some differences in audio quality. That's just the switch from our in-person discussion at Wilson's apartment, which I call Studio B, and Skype, where we added on some information the next day. Anyway, just wanted to point that out in case you're curious about what happened there. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
All right. I turned on the microphone.
Is it on? Is it on?
It looks like it's on.
All right.
It's moving. The little line is getting wider and narrower.
I can't tell because there's this new tape on the mics. And
yeah.
That's like the most exciting thing all week.
This is a tape upgrade.
This is a huge upgrade.
First of all, have you heard of gaffer's tape?
I have not.
So gaffer's tape is pretty amazing. So let me look it up.
Named after somebody?
Gaffer's tape? Oh, well, gaffer is like a job. Okay. It's like the tape that a gaffer would use.
Not and like
a gaffer,
John
I think
gaffer.
Is I don't know exactly what a gaffer is, but I think it's like maybe a cameraman or something like that. It's okay. Someone that works in something, maybe a lighting person. I don't know. Someone that works on like a theater production. And it's a very thick, fibrous tape that's sort of like duct tape, but it's more cloth than duct tape. Mm-hmm. And you can use it instead of electrical tape. You can use it instead of duct tape. It's kind of expensive compared to other tape. Like my roll of gaffer's tape was like $20, but it's a pretty big roll. It's like this big. I've been using it instead of electrical tape because I've been changing.
He motioned like the size of like a wheel of cheese.
Yeah, basically. Thank you. I forgot that this was a podcast.
I'm
for
trying
a
to include the people we're talking to.
So it's about the size of a wheel of cheese, like a large wheel, not like a massive wheel,
right?
You know, not like the type of wheel you'd get in like a cheese event, like the cheese championships or something like that.
But a good size cheddar or something like that.
But I've been using it instead of electrical tape because I've been replacing my outlets with USB outlets.
Oh, cool.
And so I want to wrap the wires in something, and I've been wrapping them with gaffer's tape because it supposedly stays adhesive longer than electrical tape. So I put gaffer's tape on the microphones. One of the reasons is that there's that light that blinks and that annoys me when we're recording. And this actually covers up the light.
Right.
And then I was also thinking it would keep us from accidentally like flipping the switch to change the direction of the mic. So I don't think we've done that, but there's a switch on the mic that says, is it like a single direction or is it trying to grab like a wide spectrum? Right. Mm-hmm. And so I set it to the single direction mic because we're both kind of talking directly into it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Like, I don't think there's really a danger of us doing that, but it would protect against that and us not noticing. And it looks cool. It looks like we know how to use these mics, right? Because there's just a big black piece of tape on it.
I mean, it definitely seems like a little bit more industrial.
Yeah. This guy knows what he's doing with the mic. Like, if I showed this mic to someone who knows about mics, they'd be like, this guy knows. Or they wouldn't. They might not say that. Anyway,
I'm thinking that they would just nod, that quiet nod. Like they won't say anything.
They'd probably think I was stupid, but they wouldn't say I was stupid.
At the same time, if they want to acknowledge you and they knew you were like an insider, they would say it. They don't want to alienate everyone in the world.
They just give a quiet nod.
And gaffers are notoriously, you know, good people.
Yeah. Okay.
Gaffers.
I don't know why you'd say that. I've never had a good conversation with a gaffer. I mean, I've never had any conversation with a gaffer, but yeah, I mean, it's a good name for a job. I guess if your title is gaffer, you probably have to have a pretty good sense of humor because it's a pretty weird title. Like it doesn't really tell you anything about.
I wonder if they're
what
like,
you do. I wonder where the name comes from.
Yeah, like their parents have to ask them over and over again what they do for a living.
Did you know? Oh, okay. So. It's you use a gaff. A gaff is a tool consisting of a large metal hook with a handle or a pole. So, if you're a lighting technician, you're putting lights on the ends of poles, I guess, and you're maybe holding them or staging them in a place. So that's why it's called that. And the gaffer's assistant is the best boy.
Best Boy.
Best Boy. Have you ever watched a movie and seen Best Boy on the credit reel?
Yeah.
I used to have this thing where I'd stay in the theater after the movie was over and watch all the credits. I don't know why, just because. There was Best Boy. Mm-hmm. And I never knew what it meant.
No, I thought it was always like the director's kid. Like, they can't give him executive producer, you know, credits and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. they'll give him something in the credit reel, right?
Yeah, fair enough. I don't know. Anyway.
It's the Best Boy. All right.
Yeah, so speaking of Best Boys, a lot of people would say you're the Best Boy of Tableau, Wilson. Not because you work with the gaffer, because we don't have one in the company, but because you look like a boy.
Mm-hmm.
You're not very tall, and you sort of a youthful face.
Yeah, I'm Asian. It's one of those things where
For the next 25 years, you're going to look like you're 20, and then you're going to look like you're 90.
Yeah,
and that's what's going to happen.
Right, like this.
But you were on a trip
mm-hmm.
This week, and I would imagine that your role on the trip when you were working with some of these clients was sort of like a best boy, in that you were kind of. There's some servitude maybe implied in your behavior with these customers. I'm not sure.
I didn't work in tape, if that's what you're asking, but
yeah. Fair enough.
I assisted in the best way I can.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think this is a very good metaphor, but if the salesperson is like the gaffer, cause they're holding out the hook to try to get the customers to bite. And
wow.
your
analogies are going wild at this point.
You're the chief assistant, and you're the best boy. In addition to your appearance, also you're kind of immature.
Mostly that.
And you have the propensity for going,
meow!
Yeah, when a customer asks us a question. Anyway.
Every meeting is like that. But yeah, I was out in Ohio this last week.
Did you vote in any presidential primaries?
I tried, but they kept on
calling
me out.
Because you don't live there?
Yeah.
Okay. So what did you do?
Ended up doing a bunch of actually different on-sites and very different use cases, different maturity level of the accounts themselves. So it was actually kind of interesting to go account to account to account, as well as, of course, just to just do a little bit of a road trip that was there. So
how many customers did you visit?
Four total over a span of basically a day and a half.
Okay.
And kind of all spread out through the Ohio area, not specifically in Cleveland. So Aurora, Warren, Akron,
wow,
and some other place in between Warren and
Would
Akron.
You drive to all those places? Like
The sales rep drove.
Is it pretty far? I mean, you drove to you rode together. You rode in a car together.
Yes. Yeah.
Was it a long drive?
About an hour each, I think.
Okay,
an hour and a half. Yeah. I think the week before, I also was out in Ohio and Indiana, and that was a bit longer, doing a bit of a road trip there between different universities at that point. But sort of an interesting 2 weeks.
Have you ever learned how to drive?
Yeah, I did it in like high school.
You just don't have a driver's license anymore.
Yeah, I kind of ditched it after like going to college. You don't drive to UW, so it's kind of
fun. Some people do, but
yeah.
Okay. You just don't have any need for it now.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Do you ever anticipate needing to get a license again, like when you go on some of these road trips?
A while back, I think, before like Uber or even taxi services were more prevalent, like a couple of years back. And this is sort of the amazing thing that when we think about it, we travel a lot for work, and it's evolved dramatically over the last couple of years. I remember the first trip I was ever, I was coming out to New York. I had to figure out where I was. There weren't like really Google Maps or Google directions that was there.
Yeah.
And you had to, still look things up in terms of figuring out where you were going. These days, of course, you can do things a lot more ad hoc. Go out to Cleveland, even if, of course, if you're out in the suburbs, you got Uber that's there, you have options, right? Mm-hmm. So There'll be times, but I'm not sure if it's urgent or if it's going to become less and less of an issue.
But if you do, you'll have to take the test again.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But I'm good at tests, you know, like culturally, like we just cram for them.
It's just your people don't even worry about things like that.
My dad will get on my case about it. Mm-hmm. But
okay. Anyway, so what'd you do with these customers? Anything interesting come up?
Yeah, it was very sort of different customer. The first one, at least for this last trip that I went out to, was more of a demo base that's there, right? A new customer, somebody who hasn't seen Tableau before, looking to deploy Tableau a little bit further. They're thinking about a larger BI project, a restructuring of their BI infrastructure. And they were kind of curious about sort of front end for it. And so we demoed through it. And one big thing that kind of came up was really a discussion of, well, they wanted a executive tool and the definition around that. And okay, I found it a little interesting.
So first of all, you said they're considering sort of a new BI deployment. Mm-hmm. And they want a front end for it.
Right.
So how do they think about that? So mm-hmm. they're thinking about, you know, they're trying to put together, they have a BI project.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and that's their idea, is we need to do BI. So are they thinking about it as in, we need to put in new databases, we need to track there's new data we need to capture, or do they already have a bunch of data in place, they're just looking to report on it?
Like, this was sort of the unique thing about basically this discussion, because usually you hear about like, oh no, we now have new streams of information coming in, we're looking at new mm-hmm. technology. Not the case for this particular customer that's there. What they were looking specifically for was they had an Analysis Cube environment,
okay,
10 years ago, and they okay. built it up and it aggregates data in a very specific way, but they know 90% of it isn't really used, and it's slow, it's starting to get bogged down, so they want to restructure it and restructure basically the cube itself, and then of course stick a front end on top of it that's there. So not at all reinventing the wheel.
So they're going to build a new cube,
right,
with new aggregations that they think are right. more relevant to
but
today.
Still exactly the same technologies okay. as they work with today.
Got it.
Cool.
So they're building this new cube. So they're kind of thinking about the questions that people now are asking of data.
Right.
And they're saying, okay, we're going to build a cube or mm-hmm. you know, pre-aggregated environment that has the answers to those questions,
right.
And then we want to put visualization
on top. Right.
Okay, and that's where you come in.
Yep.
Okay, and then they were thinking about this executive dashboarding thing.
Yeah, and so you know, we didn't learn about it until basically towards the end of the meeting. That's there. They're saying this is great, but you know, we're really looking for more of an executive tool. We're looking for very specific things.
So you came in and did a demo?
We did a demo.
You did a demo, and then they listened to the demo, and then they said, actually, we want this other thing.
Exactly, right. And it was funny because it was a split room. There were definitely IT folks in the room that were pretty curious about the technology itself.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, some of the leadership that you kind of saw trying to steer the conversation more towards the executive tool and what they were trying to do there. So
what kind of business was this? You don't have to say the name, but like, is it a education company? Mm-hmm. Is it a manufacturing company? What kind of?
I think they actually do like review of other technologies out there.
Okay.
So it was kind of where they look
so
across
some
the
sort of
industry.
Publishing
yeah.
or something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Got it.
And yeah, one of the big things that we kind of found was, okay, well, this was a need of theirs that they weren't really looking for, which at least from a meeting perspective was a good insight. And then of course, but it was interesting for me since from time to time, we just hear this issue, right? The executive dashboard concept that's there, and it's such a fluid thing as well as a very specific thing to folks.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks are going to be, we're looking for this specific feature, this look and feel, this type of pre-design.
So, okay. So when you say executive dashboard, what it makes me think of is a scorecard Ooh. Type approach where it's a very simple visualization, maybe with just a couple symbols or marks on the screen. And those, it's sort of a symbol based, you're doing okay, you're not doing okay. So there's a check mark or a exclamation point or something like that, green or red, to say you're doing good, you're doing bad. And that's maybe that's all someone ever looks at. If they're the idea is maybe there's a CEO that looks at it once a day, and he looks at it for 1 second, and he sees the check mark, and then he does whatever else he's
going to do. So the head of IT had a great way of explaining this to me.
Okay.
If the CEO, John, is going to wake up in the morning, and he wants
his name actually John?
I have no clue.
Okay.
Let's just say it's John.
That would just be very cliche, but okay.
Let's say it's Nick. So Nick. Ooh. Yeah.
Oh, never mind. This is a whole different thing now.
Whoa. Nick wakes up in the morning and wants to pick on manufacturing. He's going to be able to look across the field real quickly, drill into manufacturing, and start looking into the issue that's there.
Okay.
So that's the way he describes it. And I don't know. Maybe that is a scorecard. Maybe that is a very in-depth manufacturing.
Yeah, I guess I don't know what you call that. I mean, that's when I hear people say scorecards, that's usually what I think of.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, you know. So he is thinking about some kind of high-level category of the business, and he wants to figure out what's going on there.
Sort of an app simplified approach of drilling into information, but only giving out the right layers of information to each level that's there. And it's sort of an interesting approach.
Okay.
So it's not about, you know, what we typically talk about, which is informing the entire business, getting everybody on the same page. It's really very specifically about.
Yeah, it's interesting group. Because I think we often message Tableau as a way to make people more informed. So it's more descriptive and less prescriptive,
right.
I guess, where we tell people what the information is, and then it's their job to be smart enough to know what to do with it,
right?
But this is the idea here, I guess, is more prescriptive. It's saying, like, here's where we already know why you know you should be concerned, but you should be concerned,
right?
Which is kind of interesting. I don't know that I can necessarily say that's bad, but it is different from what we typically do. You know, why do you think that? What do you think the desire? Where do you think the desire for that comes from? For that type of analysis?
Well, I think it's some of the history of where BI tools have been, right? If it's mostly a executive tool in the past, right? People are going to look at it under the light of being an executive tool. And when we think about reporting, a lot of times it is sort of an upward movement of making sure that our upper management is aware of the situation. At least on our ground, that's there, right? So I'm not entirely sold. I'm not entirely sure it's really sort of the right, I'm interpreting it in the right way. But from my perspective, it is really just this idea where people are saying, hey, the system is broke, so let's not correct it too much.
Yeah, I've just heard a lot of people saying recently, like, there's sort of a hierarchy to types of analysis, right? And the lowest level is descriptive, and then the next level is predictive, what is going to happen. And then the highest level is prescriptive, which is what should you do, right? And I guess I understand why that's useful, because there's sort of an assumption that maybe, like, through appropriate use of data, you can offload the decision-making process to a machine that can kind of has the power to compute all the different possibilities and give you a suggestion. But I guess I sort of have problems with that approach, because I don't know if
I think it's the machine learning argument of analytics, right? Is the idea that if I am able to communicate my challenge to a smart enough computer, and let's say this computer is fed with all the right information, everything it needs to know in the world, that there is some sort of statistical way of getting to the right answer, the right approach, the right next step.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking, like, why even have a CEO if that's what you can do with data, right?
It's worth asking.
Like, why have an executive branch of your company at all if you have a machine that can make decisions for you? I don't know, maybe that's good. You know, you don't have to pay people a bunch of money to just
speeches. I would argue it's speeches mostly.
You think so?
Yeah.
Couldn't the computer just write a speech for them?
Oh God, do you think Christian's a robot?
I mean, he does have very nice speeches, but they are very scripted, right? Like when you listen to him at a conference or something, it's a very nice speech, but you can tell he wrote it beforehand.
I'm not sure I've ever seen him blink. I'm just going to put that out there.
I'm not sure he ever has, yeah. I think I read an article about him that said as a young entrepreneur, he learned to stare without blinking because he thought it was advantageous for like certain conversations he could have or something like that. I think I read that somewhere. Which is weird.
Yeah.
Christian's weird. All right.
We said it.
That guy weird. Anyway, so, okay, these guys want to do these executive dashboards.
Yeah, executive dashboards. And it was interesting in this way that, you know, the questions that kind of led up to it as well, right? They asked heavily about forecasting and things like that. So I'm not entirely sure. We went back and said, hey, you know, the best way for us to talk about this is let's give you some examples. Let you, of course, take a look at it, and then we'll discuss, right? Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to for us to say, hey, we got 15 minutes, let's run through things really quickly. That's
so did they so, give you some examples?
We will actually approach, we'll bring back some examples of what
oh,
we
I
think,
see what, you're saying.
What okay. they are thinking, which is always a weird side for me when somebody
yeah.
can't really describe what they're
I don't really
for.
Like doing things that way where it's like we're kind of trying to we're just throwing stuff out there and just seeing if something
yeah,
makes
it's,
sense
it's a shotgun approach but you know at the end of the day sometimes it has to be that way right mm-hmm. especially when the customer isn't quite capable mm-hmm. of explaining what their need or what they're looking for is and you know to that degree I mean I'm looking at this particular you know, deal that we're looking at and it might not necessarily be the strongest fit simply because if there's urgency then people can specify and really understand what they're urgent about.
Yeah. Yeah, for a long time people sort of looked down upon formula-based or machine-driven analytics that mm-hmm. made suggestions about what to do because I think the kind of ancient opinion is to be like, well, this machine doesn't have the gut instinct that I do as an executive, right? And it doesn't know what it's like to be in the moment with sitting in another room with another executive and making a decision based on what's best. And you know, and I think that's kind of stupid. Like, I think in involving the best analytics into decision making processes is correct.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it should be like one of many options
right.
for making decisions. And I'm afraid that using like an approach where a formula always makes a suggestion
mm-hmm.
Excludes maybe different angles, right? Because when you create a mathematical equation to spit out a result, you're kind of making a bunch of assumptions and you have sort of controls and variables and things
right.
like that. And if you haven't considered a tertiary piece of information, then it can be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, I guess that's the problem I have with that. And it's kind of the message behind Tableau is that, you know, what happens when there's a question based on something you haven't anticipated.
Right. It's funny, like you said, it's a little bit of it's a cultural shift around
mm-hmm.
what we really believe business and deal making is. In the 80s, late 80s and early 90s, I would probably say, you know, we saw people like Donald Trump really kind of being admired for their business skills. It's a lot about like
mm-hmm.
gut instinct, their read of the people that's there, their understanding of specifically what's going on. And
I'd say he's still quite commercially viable, I mean, based on his, his polling numbers, but anyway.
But as we kind of evolved, right, what was it, the Watson beat Ken Jennings, you know, and we started to see a little bit of an evolution there where, of course, this is a much more viable thing. And then finally, of course, we're starting to still see. And I think the one thing that doesn't really still come to light is that idea of a human driven analytics solution where it's really informing the decision and really, of course, still providing the right level of information that's there. So you lent me The Martian, the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still reading through it. It's taking me a bit of time. But it's funny because the reading through that book, it actually does highlight really good data-driven decisions through it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, some of it is gut-driven. You have to understand specific pieces of information, new information coming in, and people inquire opinions and things like that. But they also kind of weigh the actual numbers that are behind the scenes that's there. And it's not about, at that point, reading another person in the room. It's not about anything like that. It is reading a situation, saying, what should we
do? Yeah, I think the different, in my mind, I think this is the right way to describe it, is, you know, machines aren't great at incorporating new sources of information to existing models without some sort of calibration, right? So if there's suddenly a new feed of information that exists, it's difficult to just plug that into whatever model that you've built for decision making through a formula. But a human might be able to make assumptions based on those things just through kind of broad strokes and looking at patterns. So I think the only correct way to make good decisions is to incorporate both of those ways of thinking into analysis and say, okay, what does the formula say? And then what do I think? And if you think something different, then figure out why. You know, why does my gut tell me something different than this? Is it because I have misconceptions, or is it because I'm incorporating information that the formula isn't incorporating?
Right. So sort of algorithm-driven analytics is really good at driving the same analysis over and over again and reacting based off the parameters that exist, right? But when you have competing algorithms, even, of course, in like the stock market and ETFs that we have today, right? What you start to see is that system starting to break down dramatically, because you then need, of course, people thinking about the situation. And then basically it is a bit of an arms race in terms of figuring out how things can be optimized further and further from here, right?
Yeah, I was with a customer a couple of weeks ago that was talking about scorecarding. And they were kind of saying, they sort of have an idea for this sort of dashboard, which is what you're describing, which is kind of more of a KPI-based visualization that just has a list of different things that that this business tracks. This is like a consumer packaged goods company, and they track all these different metrics, and they want, if one of them is kind of off what they expect, they want to basically link into a dashboard. And I thought the interesting thing that they were doing was they were... they're saying, okay, well, we want to, you know, if one of them is different than what we expect, we want to click and then go into the detail, right? But they had like a different model for each metric. So they're like, the dashboard for this one is going to be very different from the dashboard for this other one.
Right.
So it wasn't as simple as kind of in a Tableau perspective, doing basic filter actions and things like that. It was really like a URL to a different page for each one, which is fine. You can do that with Tableau. But I thought that was an interesting idea, and I'm not sure. I mean, I kind of just communicated the facts in the meeting. Like, I was like, well, you could do that. You could use URL actions to link to different dashboards. And you'd have a different dashboard for each metric, and you'd create links. That's simple. But I was thinking afterward, like, whether that's the right way to do things or not. And I think it's, I mean, the good thing about that approach is that you're thinking about each thing as its own independent entity. So, like, you're potentially doing things fine, because at least you're acknowledging that each item doesn't fit in the same model, right? It's kind of thinking about, okay, well, what is the right way to analyze each of those things? But at the same time, like, why would you have one standard dashboard to track all of them then?
Right.
I'm not sure exactly how that all fits together.
And I think that that's part of the challenge with these sort of executive scorecards, right? You have a lot of things that are moving and interchangeable over time. So part of that model actually makes a whole lot of sense, right? You link out the things, and if the metric itself needs to be tracked very differently over time, we basically update the underlying dashboard for that specific metric that's there. And so from a development standpoint, modularizing tends to be actually a really good strategy. As opposed to thinking about this massive, you know, tree of how we actually develop this thing out that's there, that this has to drill into this and this, so forth and so forth. But the problem I think that does exist is whether or not, you know, one dashboard is the end goal. And it's worth debating, I think, because at the end of the day, I think the biggest thing that we find is that, you know, when you read the front page of New York Times, is that effectively giving you a full world view of everything? Or is it what's more important just saying, here are the things that are updated mm-hmm. and we should be reinformed
well,
about what's there?
You bring up a good point, which is that right now it seems like the, at least for businesses, it seems mm-hmm. like the common idea of how data analysis should work mm-hmm. is that when anyone has a question, they should be able to ask the question and get the answer. Right.
Right.
That seems to be the common message that businesses are hearing that people have ideas about for
right.
how they should consume data.
Right.
Like if you look at like the Watson Analytics thing or the what's the woman's name from Microsoft, Cortana,
mm-hmm.
like Cortana BI, right? All of that is based around someone having like an idea, being like, oh, I wonder what happened in sales in
right.
New Jersey last year. And
mm-hmm.
then you get an answer, right? But then when you get to the products are all giving you dashboards,
mm-hmm.
which is not that. That's not what it is. It's not giving you the ability to ask questions and get answers. It's telling you what the questions are
right.
and then giving you the, being like, you're allowed to ask these 10 questions,
right.
but you'll get the answer really fast if you ask one of them.
Yeah.
Which is just, I wonder how that happened. You know, I wonder why there's that difference between how people think analytics should work, even in the companies that do those things,
mm-hmm.
right? Like even in the vendors that just make dashboards, the way they sell it to people was saying, hey, anyone who has a question can just ask the question using this dashboard,
mm-hmm.
right? But that's not what it does.
No. Yeah, I think it's just demoing. You know,
mm-hmm.
part of the dark arts of what we do, right, all day is, you know, masking what we think might not sell well
mm-hmm.
To people, of course, who have a grand vision but are asking very specific things, right? And sometimes, of course, we take a easier route down that path, right? Instead of saying, well, you know, our tool is not designed to do, you know, the focus of our tool should be done this way. You know, people, of course, look to say, okay, no, we got a quick answer for you.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask it in this way, then we can solve your question really, really quickly.
Okay. Yeah. I'm interested in digging into that a little more because I think we've sort of stumbled on an interesting topic, which is like this idea of dashboards and their role in analytics and how they become sort of the predominant
mm-hmm.
methodology for doing analytics in business. So maybe that's what we can do. We can kind of jump into next. Let's take a break.
I need a drink.
Yeah, we drank our drinks. We'll come back in a minute, and then we'll talk about that.
All right.
Good job, everybody. All right, we're back. So I went on a gin tour yesterday at this distillery called Green Hook Ginsmiths near my place in Greenpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And
Ginsmiths? Like that's
I think that's just the name of their business.
It's they not like a real thing.
They're Smiths of Gin. They make gin.
Yeah, I was just trying to make sure it wasn't like a thing now, because then you have like Whiskey Smiths.
Is that a thing? Have you heard that word before? I've never heard the word Whiskey Smith.
No, but I'm just worried that
I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere in the world there was someone that called themselves a Whiskey Smith.
Then we'd have to worry about what a Dustin Smith does.
I think we know. I think we know. So I went on a tour of their distillery. They make three types of gin. So they make a London Dry gin, which is like the typical gin most people drink.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They make a what they call a Beach Plum gin. So that was interesting. So have you ever heard of a slow gin before? SLOE.
Yeah.
So it's made from plums, basically.
Yep.
And their plums are sort of native to Europe, specifically like UK and the western part of Europe. So apparently this place was, they wanted to make a slow gin, but they couldn't find slow plums.
Mm-hmm.
So they learned that beach plums, which are native to New York, are a relative of the slow plums. They made a gin with the beach plums, which is pretty good.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of a sweeter, cordial type liqueur. Mm-hmm. And then they have the Old Tom Gin, mm-hmm. which is what we're drinking. So that's a more traditional type of gin, which is aged. It's made like gin in that it's grain alcohol and juniper berries, but then it's aged and processed more like whiskey. And so it's typically better in things like what they suggested to make it in was like a Martinez, which is kind of like a martini, but it's made more like a Manhattan. So it's a drink you serve up with vermouth like a martini, but then you'll also use like bitters or something like that. What we had earlier was sort of like that, but then it was kind of more like an old fashioned because we muddled an orange in it. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty good. That was kind of a nice cocktail that was sort of boozy. And then now what we're drinking is sort of like a Tom Collins, but we added vermouth to it. So it's kind of like a tart fizz.
Fizz, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the noticeable thing about this one, of course, it's the color, which is very different than the...
Yeah, it's not clear. It's got a brown tint, and that's from aging it in oak barrels.
Yeah. So very cool. Very, yeah. Very interesting.
And they, what they do at this distillery, which I thought was interesting, and I don't know if it's unique to them or if other people do it too, but they do what they call vacuum distilling.
Huh.
So they're still... they can create a vacuum. They can, like, extract air from it and change the pressure so they can distill at a very low temperature. They don't have to boil to distill. And so that's useful because when you use herbs and juniper and all the things you use in gin, they can get damaged by heat.
So they're still boiling, but they're not applying heat to boil.
Yeah, if you remove pressure from the environment, then it boils at a lower temperature.
Right.
Yeah. So it was kind of an interesting little tour, and I picked up that bottle, and I think it's pretty good. It's pretty good. People actually have been complaining to me about how we don't have enough cocktail recipes on this show. Because when I first made our website, I put cocktail recipes in like the headline.
Well, I think I'm at fault for that. I've been on a bit of, I wouldn't say cleanse, but I've just been avoiding alcohol for a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's no problem. But I think maybe I just need to speak up more when we are having a drink and saying, this is what we're drinking. So this is what we're drinking. Green Hook Gin Smith's Old Tom Gin.
Pretty tasty.
100 proof. The current drink is gin, vermouth, lemon, a little bit of simple syrup, ice, and soda. Mm-hmm. So kind of like a Tom Collins, but you add some vermouth in there for a little extra flavor. That's it. That's what we're having. Dashboards. And we were just talking about dashboards.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting that we're just talking about these dashboards and like the cool different dashboards that you and I had made recently.
Mm-hmm.
And before our break, we were kind of ragging on dashboards a little bit.
Right.
I don't think we need to get into like an extensive conversation of what makes a good dashboard and what doesn't, because that's kind of a whole talk in itself. That's probably would take a while. But I do kind of want to go into this conversation about why dashboard became sort of the default for data analysis and why that sort of became the hot word and the hot thing to do in businesses around visualization. What do you think the reasoning behind that is?
What drew it? Well, I think it was sort of a novel concept when people are used to seeing reports, and now all of a sudden you're looking at real-time data to try to drive your business that's there, right? And mm-hmm. so the analogy and everything about basically really, of course, of leading your business, really driving your business that's there, just kind of played really well to it. But as we kind of explore what that really means in this market, right? And then that's really what BI is, right? It's an exploration of how do we make the most use of data that we're collecting. What we find is that oftentimes that varies, and oftentimes that doesn't, that's good up front, but doesn't, of course, solve everything.
Right. Yeah, I guess I look back to what I know about the history of data analysis and databases and things like that. And Barry, our enterprise sales VP, kind of puts it very succinctly, saying, you know, we started off with this database thing, which has been around for, what, 50 or 60 years, right? Mm-hmm. And that was a great way of tracking and storing information. And then at some point, people realized in like the 80s and 90s that to analyze the information and get a lot out of it, it was sort of inefficient.
Right.
To be able to process all these transactions in a meaningful way. And so the cube kind of emerged,
yep.
Right? And so this online analytical processing, is that what OLAP yep. stands for?
Something like that.
Allowed people to pre-aggregate data to say, okay, right. Well, to make it more efficient for people to ask questions of data, we're going to take
some guy would
combinations
try to
of
think about all the combinations of what we want to ask, and he would just try to, of course, push those results, and performance would be fast enough that we could ask all the questions that's there. But
and so we'd store the answers to those questions in this, what we'd call a cube,
right.
And it's called a cube because you think of all the different dimensions of which you'd want to ask questions. That might be, I'd want to know sales by region and by category. I want to know profit by sales rep and by year, right? And you can kind of think, and so it's a cube because it's multidimensional.
I'm really curious if the first cube was actually just three dimensions. It would be interesting. I don't know.
It's possible. Yeah, I don't know.
I'm being an idiot right now. But anyways,
that's
the cube.
Yeah,
right?
And then from there, I think how that sort of evolved was into this dashboard thing, which was kind of, how do we present the information that we're pre-aggregating and assuming that people have questions of, and put it in a format that's easy for people to understand. And in a lot of ways, because of that, a dashboard sort of is a cube. It's just a nice presentation of a cube. It's saying, here's what all the questions are, here's what the information behind those questions are, and you can ask, you can kind of manipulate it and get different cuts of the information, but it kind of fits within the lens of whoever asks the questions.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it, right? It's through the lens of the developer of that dashboard. And we've simplified, I think, sort of the dashboard process over years. There's a number of tools that do that beyond Tableau. And it's really just a matter of whether or not that ends up being a true definition of BI. In my mind, it's not. It's actually what happens, where the hard work is, where, you know, the analyst is actually working with desktop and starting with a blank slate. But
right. But at the same time, like, I think we have to kind of admit that some of the things about dashboards, some of the reasons that dashboards became prevalent in the world are pretty valid. Like, how do you make someone care about information, right? Like, if you need to present information to someone, how do you present in a way that's going to make them actually curious and ask questions?
Well, let's reel it back. I don't think dashboards themselves necessarily do that. A good dashboard does, right? We start talking about elements of storytelling and things like that, but for the most part, dashboards are there to steer what the business is doing, right? Or it's there to reflect of what's the business.
I mean, that's
is
a
at.
Good. I'm glad you brought that up because I think the whole term dashboards,
right,
comes from the idea that it's exactly what you described, that it's something that you look at as you maneuver whatever business challenges you go through, and it kind of tells you what direction you're going. It tells you how fast you're going, whatever, you know. I think that was the initial idea behind dashboards, was that it was just information to monitor as you ran your business.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that it's kind of evolved into something. Well, the term self-service has kind of permeated that same space. When someone thinks of someone who uses self-service data analysis, they think of dashboards usually.
Right.
And I think to me that says that dashboards are there for people that want information to present it to them in an easy and provocative fashion. Would you disagree with that?
No, I think that's true. I think as we kind of move along, where there's more and more streams of data, right? In order to sell that information better, mm-hmm. you simply need to really kind of approach it from that aspect that's there, right? You have to, of course, approach it from how do we actually sell the importance of this? And a lot of times that's really a focus around storytelling.
And I wonder how much of that is driven by, you know, I don't know if this is like a passive aggressive effort, but some effort by the people who are stewards of information to make business people more engaged with data, right? Do you think that plays a role in this? I don't know if it does.
I think so. I think so. You know, data is data. And of course, if you just lay out information that's there without telling a story around it, nobody really cares, to be honest, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you could, of course, list all the stock prices in your financial section that's there. But until you, of course, editorialize it, people aren't going to necessarily understand mm-hmm. what they should actually understand out of it. And that's not necessarily a problem. It's really just a way of thinking around the communication tools that we have readily available there. So as we kind of think through it, it's not necessarily that one force is driving the other, but, you know, we're bombarded with more information. So of course, for more the importance of information to rise, right? We have to compete in that market. Mm-hmm. And we have to, of course, be more focused, more specific, more oriented to the customer's needs, which oftentimes is about how can I convey this information to the next user, you know, which right. involves storytelling.
Okay. We're on day two now. After thinking about it a little more, I thought we could go into a little more detail about this storytelling concept, because I think our conversation was sort of leading to this idea that the thing that makes a dashboard successful is actually this storytelling thing. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I noticed when we were talking yesterday was we actually, after we recorded, you showed me some visualizations you had made for a customer. Mm-hmm. And you had made a visualization where you compared gender enrollment rates in different colleges. Right, mm-hmm. So you're looking at different schools and what the percentage of men and women were in each each different college within a university.
Right.
And my initial thought mm-hmm. for how you would do that would be you'd use kind of standard colors mm-hmm. to show percents of total for women and men. So you'd use like a pink or something, and then you use a blue for men, right? But on your viz, you actually did like orange and gray. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an interesting choice. Can you talk a little bit about why you did that?
Yeah, I mean, especially when we start to think about, you know, allowing people to kind of really understand what information that they're looking at, to really kind of challenge sort of their thought and belief structure around what they kind of see at in terms of the data. One of the things that you want to do is just kind of buck some of the typical trends that might be used to kind of signify specific types of data that's there. So I especially wanted to kind of avoid sort of the blue and pink type of approach to kind of describing gender. It might have actually been easier, I think, for most folks to kind of scan through that and quickly understand what's going on. But one of the big things is I think, you know, people start to lose track and they carry on with the same assumptions as if you, as opposed to, of course, if you presented this data in a sort of fresh light, and in this case, a fresh coat of paint, right? And see what type of information they can have interpret from there.
Yeah, I think that's an important trait to this idea of storytelling. So the reason I asked you about that one was it was just something that we had discussed yesterday, but I think when we think about storytelling, I think a lot of times we think about how text is presented or the sequence and things that are presented. But when we're talking about dashboards, I think a lot of the choices that affect how a story is told are design elements like color or or things like that. And the reason I thought that was especially interesting in your situation was, like you said, it sort of breaks with these sort of assumptions, and that makes the view more engaging. So one of the things that when you're creating a dashboard, you have to think about is how to draw in the reader of the dashboard. I think a lot of times the dashboards we were sort of saying weren't as good in our previous segment were things like scorecards, where there's sort of a static view. They've set up a list of questions prior to the analysis that are for answering in that dashboard, and they sort of assume that the person looking at the dashboard kind of comes in with that frame of mind. I think a better use is when a dashboard is provocative and actually creates the question in someone's mind as they're looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, I think a big part around it is the focal point, right? And really making sure that when we design a dashboard, when we design something that is even interactive or even a visual that is supposed to interpret some sort of information, that there's one design element that kind of stands out as being the key point that is driving your information that you want people to examine. In my use case here, at least in gender distribution, it was the distribution that was actually a lot more important than the colors that kind of defined the different breakup that's there. And so in my situation, really, of course, making sure that the layout, in this case, how the distribution kind of curves from sort of the different schools and how big of a swing we really saw across the different schools on that campus ended up being much more important. And of course, making sure that that ends up being sort of the big key point that's driven ends up being the real point around sort of storytelling, at least from the example that I have there. But I think it kind of comes back together in terms of thinking around focal points around your dashboard that's there. Sometimes you see it and it's kind of overdone. You know, you and I have both kind of looked at different either the VizWiz entries or different story point submissions where people get a little bit too focused on being conclusive, trying to provide an answer to what they're showing. And I find a lot of sort of issues around that, right? Because a lot of times we're not trying to explain everything that we do see. We're just trying to show it to the next person.
Yeah, the idea of accents or call-outs, or as you called it, kind of focal points, I think is a good kind of guiding design principle for how to tell a story in a dashboard, because in another version of the report that you created, you might actually choose to use more standard colors for male and female students because you want those to sort of blend into the background a little more and have them have people not notice them as much and notice other things instead, right? So something as subtle as a color choice can change the story just because it'll make people notice your point in a different way.
Right.
Yeah.
In this case, it's the bias of understanding gender diversity in different schools, right? Right. And really, of course, challenging it. But yeah, I think about that a whole lot when we actually look at things. Actually, just a little bit earlier today, I was looking at a customer dashboard and...
Sorry. Hold on just a moment. Hold that thought. Hold on. Okay. I'll edit that out, I guess. Okay, so what were you saying?
So I was actually looking at a dashboard a little bit earlier today from a customer who was struggling with performance challenges. And, you know, you open up the dashboard and the immediate thing you notice is that there's every part of the screen is actually filled with a different mark that's there, whether it's the they had a lot of spark lines, a lot of KPIs that was there. And I think I didn't even count overall, but I believe there were, it really did feel like there was no part of the screen that wasn't at least filled with something that was trying to describe more information. And when you hover over it, there's a lot more text underneath the tooltip. And in a lot of ways, I think a lot of people look at that and say, oh, that's a really good scorecard because it provides a lot of information. But the biggest problem that we typically see is that the performance challenges that kind of come hand in hand with poor design kind of also comes into play when we just try to offload as much information as possible. The whole idea is that you end up failing to tell a story if all you're doing is just doing very descriptive ideas of trying to describe everything you see. It's kind of the three-year-old telling you a story of their day, and they recount every little detail throughout sort of the information that's there, and it really ends up being a poor way of communicating information further. Mm-hmm. So I think about that a whole lot, and when we think about sort of dashboarding, I think you need to know what you're focusing on, but you need to of course also loosen up and be comfortable that you won't necessarily provide a conclusion or a solution to the situation, but reporting on it will at least, of course, make the situation a little bit more transparent and for folks to hopefully at least find a solution to the potential issue that you see.
Right. Yeah. So you're saying in these situations where there's a lot of stuff on the screen, is that something that you don't think is useful in storytelling? Because you mentioned the performance issues there, but what does that say to you in terms of like design?
Well, from a design standpoint, I think there's a few things to consider. One, from sort of a BI initiative perspective, we see a lot of these sort of approaches where I need all these different monitoring tools, I need all these different scorecards, and it becomes over-focused on the idea of just trying to describe everything and predict all the questions that might not actually be there, right? Or to, of course, apply old thought and old knowledge to what we currently see without really, of course, thinking about whether how it applies to some of the challenges that people are really facing or the things that people are really, of course, prioritizing as an initiative within the business. So that's a sort of a consideration there.
Yeah, I think, sorry to interrupt, but I think generally, like, our philosophy is going to be dashboards should be more subject-oriented, mm-hmm. right? They should be around specific questions and points that can be easily understood within a minute or something like that, rather than being huge and exploratory and requiring a lot of kind of visual parsing to get out different
right.
points. And that it's interesting that the design principle there sort of just ties into what's best performing and what's easiest to do in Tableau. I don't know if that's like we're biased or if Tableau is built in a way that encourages good design. It's probably both, but it's just sort of interesting to note that.
Yeah, I think there's another part around it where it is just the evolution of the technology that's there, right? It's gotten fast enough that we want to be basically a tool to kind of think about how we break news to other people that's there. And oftentimes, how you, of course, understand that story and, of course, the information flowing in is going to be a little bit more unique. And so we put a lot more weight around ad hoc being something that ends up helping us drive the business or helping us at least inform what's really going on to it. Mm-hmm. Not to, of course, discount sort of the monitoring stuff. That still has a role, but it doesn't end up being an exercise of basically let's try to capture everything and through the monitoring of everything, through these very complex, the detailed information that's there, we can of course easily pick up all the information and all the changes that might be, of course, that might signify something that we might need to pay attention to.
Okay. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this idea recently around what visual principles tell the best stories. And so the use of color that we talked about is something that I've been thinking about, but also I've been thinking about the use of white space, right? Because I think a lot of the time, not showing on something on the screen can tell a better story than showing something. The example that I've learned a lot about this during like going through the Makeover Monday stuff with, on Andy Kriebel's blog. So one of the things that I'm trying to do, I've done three or four of those, and they're great sort of exercises to practice just thinking about how to design a visual display that adheres to a very specific story, right? You kind of know what the story is going to be going in, and you can just think about how to tell the story best visually. So I really like that exercise. I would encourage people listening to try it if they haven't already. One of the things that I was thinking about during the last one, And this is actually on our website if people want to look at it. It's the Mind the Gap viz about English Premier League salaries. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about white space because I have this chart that shows sort of a line demarcating the difference in salary for a soccer player in 1985 to 2015. Mm-hmm. And the line is intended to show the gap between those two numbers. Mm-hmm. And there's, because of the big difference in Premier League versus the difference in like lower level soccer leagues in England, there's a big white space on the viz. And I was thinking a lot about that white space when I was creating this dashboard, because I think a natural tendency I would have is I would want to fill that white space. I think that's actually like a design principle a lot of graphic designers think about, is there shouldn't be asymmetrical white space on a visual thing.
Right.
But in this, I decided to leave it and not redesign at all. I could have maybe hovered one of my bar charts in that space or something like that, but I actually decided to leave it because I thought that helped tell the story, right? Because there's such a big gap between the high-level soccer leagues and the lower-level soccer leagues that the white space helps you notice that. And so I was thinking about that, and I think there's a—I don't know if that's the best way to do it. That was the decision I made. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that, you know, I'm not the best visual designer in the world, but that's how I decided to do it, and I thought that helped. But I've noticed in other situations, mm-hmm. I will leave something out, or I'll create a visual of some kind that is maybe missing one little indicator that would help people understand what exactly is being displayed. Mm-hmm. And so like something as simple as, so something I think I did wrong on that viz was I think I needed actually more defining lines, right? Like I was trying to kind of think about the data to ink ratio that we've talked about before, which is take away most ink that is not related to data. But I think what ended up happening on this viz is that it almost looks like the lower end lines on those lines showing the differences, it almost looks like they all start on the same axis, and therefore it's more of a bar chart than a width difference chart, right? And I think if I had a line there, you'd be able to tell that they're not all adjusted to the side there, and that you're actually measuring something other than a bar. So that's another little thing where, you know, it's like white space and you're thinking about these little indicators that are helping tell the story, even though they're not visually oriented. And I think that's a really big part of storytelling, especially with data. You know, you don't really think about that as being an important part of how to communicate a message. But I think when you're creating a visual, those little things that are the difference between someone understanding your point and not understanding it turn out to be very important. And so that's why I think, I don't know, I don't know how that relates to the scorecarding thing. I mean, it seems like what we're talking about is a pretty big departure from that.
Well, I think it does kind of tie back into some of the design principle and some of the flaws that I think we typically do see that come from, that most naturally kind of manifests itself in scorecards, right? We see people maximizing as much of the real estate as possible. They're trying to fill up as much information and to actually bring in all the disparate pieces of information all in one spot. And what ends up happening, I think, as you kind of mentioned, is you lose a lot of good design principles in that process that's there. You know, you lose the sense of how white space actually plays with the information so that we understand magnitudes better. We lose the sense of basically what things ought to be related to one another, or what things have stronger correlations to each other, as opposed to, of course, just everything is tied together in some unexplained way. And so I think that kind of ends up being sort of what we typically do see. I mean, I'm a fan of scorecards at the end of the day. I think I've built my fair share of it, but I think it does kind of is a very, what it ends up being is a very base level of reporting and conveying information. And I think we need to, of course, very specifically think of it in that light. And not sort of an end-all, be-all solution to BI that's there. If that's the end goal, there's a lot of different tools out there that will simply do that, right? And that will focus better on it. What we do find is that there is that gap, though, that comes between basically that scorecarding and to, of course, really act as a tool of information and curiosity and to really kind of use it as a communication tool to inform, right? So I think you're right. We're right on the path where design does kind of interfere with some of the core principles of what scorecarding actually does.
Let me ask you, if we were able to train everyone in the world to be good storytellers with data, and dashboards, instead of being sort of these kind of big, all-encapsulating kind of monoliths that sometimes told stories and sometimes didn't, and were more exploratory, and kind of morphed into better answers of questions and provokers of thought, would that be, do you think that's like our ideal state for analytics in a business?
That's a tough question.
What I'm trying to get at, and it's sort of a leading question, is I think that's part of it. And then I think the other part is giving people more power to ask their own questions, right, through ad hoc capabilities and things like that.
Right.
But I guess I'm trying to get at, like, what percentage of analytics do you think can be captured by dashboards and stories, and what percentage needs to be captured by other tools and things like that?
Right. I mean, I think down the road, if we want to really have a fully fleshed out BI strategy that's there, in my mind, you'll dedicate about 20% of it to monitoring tools and ways for people to stay informed, check in on things, to be able to look with some of the past lens into, of course, the current data that's there, right? Mm-hmm. So that's my understanding in terms of how we think about an analytics team that is actively feeding information. The other 80%, I really believe, is that ad hoc approach for folks to be actively looking for new insights, to be sharing those insights. And those are things that are very specific in nature that can go deep as opposed to going broad. And that end up, of course, being conveyed through stories a lot more often than just, of course, in the layout of information that's there. So in my mind, I think it is sort of a necessary foundation. We can't get around it. And of course, as tools start to develop, like having better tools for even alerting other mechanisms for getting information, like our subscriptions, those things will slowly kind of eat into that monitoring aspect of it. But where you see active thought and active progress is really in that 80%. It's such a hard thing to define what that actually is.
So do you consider, when you say monitoring, just clarify that for me, is that these sorts of storytelling dashboards, do they fall into monitoring as well as the more traditional BI dashboards?
Mm-hmm.
They do, or are they more... do they fall more into the ad hoc camp?
I think the scorecards and things like that do fall into more the traditional.
Right, but the monitoring. Like a good dashboard, like a
good dashboard. A little bit of both, to be honest, right? Not all monitoring tools are going to be all encompassing. There are things that are going to be tracking a very specific story. And that's where I think sort of the ad hoc projects feed into what you monitor. That being said, it's sort of it fits into kind of both realms, more or less, more so with ad hoc, but definitely I still think it has a big role to play with telling us how the business have been run and how we should look at the data in a specific way.
Okay, cool. I think the way that it is right now, I think people typically envision BI as sort of the opposite allocation, right? The way people typically think about business intelligence, I think they're thinking the 80% is actually the monitoring and the 20% is when people have sort of this sort of niche case where they want to answer their own question, right? And I'm more inclined to agree with you, but I think it's interesting that that's sort of where we're at right now. But I guess, 10, 20 years ago, it probably was even more angled toward the traditional BI approach, where it's really just about reports.
Well, it's immediate pain points, right? And you know, for us, we've been kind of involved enough, I think, with Tableau over years to kind of at least see what the potential can be. And not to mention, I think internally, we do actually have a pretty strong BI culture that we've kind of been a little spoiled with. But that being said, I think the immediate pain point most people have is just the day-to-day work, that these things can be automated in some fashion. So that's where the focus is going into. I don't think it's necessarily the end vision. And so when I hear that people just want to do the first part and forget about the second part, you know, I think that's where, you know, this is why we really want to remind them that there's an actual second part to all of this. There's something, I think, there's a much more collaborative state, I think, that BI can fit into the business as opposed to really just offering a very basic service.
Yeah, but the thing that continues to bother me is that I think, like we said earlier, like I think the vision of BI, like the way a BI company would describe BI, is pretty close to what we would say is the ideal case, right? Of people can ask questions. Whenever they have a question of data, they'll be able to get the answer really quickly. They won't have to rely on technical resources. They won't have to go decode a piece of software. They'll just be able to get the answer, right? But then when in practice, it turns out to be a dashboard building platform, and that's it.
It is.
And I guess that's just something to continue to kind of monitor and pay attention to and see if that changes and if we can do anything to kind of move it closer toward what we would describe as the ideal state or whatever. But I do think it's weird that even the companies that maybe we would compete with would probably describe business intelligence in the way that we think is right. And yet in practice, it's something different.
Right. I don't think it's actually really prevalent right now. I'm kind of curious right now how many people in a given organization actually has access to BI tools. And so and by BI tools, you know, for us, I'm thinking much more on the terms of desktop, right? Or having some of those capabilities to connect new data and to work through it. So I think there's definitely work that we need to do to continue kind of enabling the tools to the right people and to, of course, build out the use case a little bit further. But I think it's still a challenge, right? At the end of the day, there might be cost-related issues or, of course, issues around even capabilities that they, you know, folks have today or, of course, where they really kind of fall in the maturity cycle that is really kind of preventing them from, of course, exploring things even further. I agree. I think it's definitely something that we need to just pay a little bit more attention to and, of course, make sure that we continue advocating that, folks need to be more collaborative with their data as opposed to just using it as a simple platform to convey some information out there.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing I think I want to investigate, and maybe this is like next episode or something like that, is why do people correlate a dashboarding tool with ad hoc analytics or being able to ask questions of data, right? Is that because that's like what the human vision for being able to access information is dashboards about everything, right? Mm-hmm. Or is it because they've been sold that for so long that they think that's how it works? Or, you know, I don't presume to say that like Tableau desktop drag and drop kind of pivot table approach is the ideal way to analyze data, but I think it's about as good as there is right now. And so I'm interested in kind of investigating why that might be different for what people's assumptions are.
Yeah. And we're starting to see an emergence of a number of different UIs really for that, right? Natural language being a part of the question. And of course the whole dashboarding concept is still something I think that, you know, a lot of people think of when they want their questions answered. It's worth exploring, I think, for us to kind of really understand whether or not, that is the ideal way. Who knows? You know, some folks really don't want to actually get their hands dirty, right? So I know you and I don't fall into that category, but it's worth for us to kind of understand.
I don't really like getting my hands dirty.
I do.
Just generally.
I get my hands dirty all the time.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you have to wash them afterwards and, you know.
Is this why I picked
that? Yeah, it might be. Okay. That's gross. So to recap, we actually covered quite a bit. I think if you back up to kind of where we started talking about kind of where BI projects emerge and the idea that machine-driven analytics and automated analytics can help a certain degree, but exploratory and storytelling techniques actually help a lot as well. And looking for places where that can be done in conjunction is sort of a good way to make analytics provocative and engaging for people within an organization. I think, one we talked briefly just there about the Makeover Monday thing, and I think that's something I would really encourage people to do if they want to practice telling stories with data. I think it's a tremendously helpful activity. So if you want to try that, you can go to Andy Kriebel's blog at vizwiz.blogspot.com, vizwiz.blogspot.com. And every week he puts up a new data set and a visualization to look at, and encourages anyone who wants to download it and try their hand at creating a best practices visualization. And those are all tracked and stored on Twitter and through Pinterest, so you can see what other people have done. And I think it's been really beneficial for me, I think. If you want to look at my example that I talked about in terms of the English Premier League salaries, you can find that on our website at tableauontableau.com. And if you want to find Wilson's example that he talked about, you can't, because
Right.
it's not it's using customer data, so we can't share it. Sorry.
There's
It's a great viz though.
a NDA. Yeah, there's an NDA around it.
It's a
I'll
really
rebuild it
nice
at some.
looking viz. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll rebuild
It's
that at some
actually
point.
yeah. I think it's the type of viz that could really lead to a lot of benefits to the world, like curing cancer and just general peace on Earth.
Saving
It's
puppies.
too bad we can't
Yeah,
share it with anyone.
it's too bad. I mean, yeah, maybe a few years down the road, right?
All right, we'll wait. We'll wait for world peace until then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Wilson. Great job.
Good work, too.
Thanks a lot. Well, thank you.